You are listening to the Effective Statistician, episode number 38, The Past, Present and Future of Estimates, an interview with Chrissy Fletcher and Mona Akacha. Welcome to the Effective Statistician with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, the weekly podcast for statisticians in the health sector designed to improve your leadership skills, widen your business acumen, and enhance your efficiency. We are creating an online course for improving your leadership skills as a statistician, even if you have no direct reports. So register now your interest on the page theeffectivestatistician.com/course. In today's episode, we'll talk about estimates. Why it's important for us, why the concept itself is important, and what are the implications. We'll talk about the terminology of the estimate framework and also explore how it relates to missing data terminology. The guests are absolute fantastic. They are key players in this field, and if you go to conferences, you will see Chrissy's and Mona's name very, very often presenting on this topic. Very, very nice interview guests, so stay tuned for this amazing episode. This podcast is created in association with PSI, a global member organization dedicated to leading and promoting best practice and industry initiatives. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to special interest groups, the video on demand content library, free registration to upcoming PSI events, and much, much more. Visit the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about upcoming PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. This is Alexander Schacht, and today I'm without my co-host Benjamin because his child is sick, so I'm alone here from my side, but I have two very, very nice guests, Mona from Novartis and Chrissy from Amgen. Hello together.
Hi there.
Hello.
Okay, very good. Maybe we start with a little bit of an introduction first of what have brought you to this topic, what you're currently working on, and what's your kind of feeling about estimates. So Mona, maybe we can start with you first.
Okay, so thank you first of all for having me here today. So my name is Mona, as you've already said. I'm working in the statistical methodology group at Novartis for around 8 years now. And regarding your question, what brought me to estimates? So I think this is already going back like 4 to 5 years by now. So when the concept paper was published 2014, I remember that my manager came to me and said, "You're our expert on missing data." So my PhD was in missing data, hence somewhat of an expertise in that area. And he essentially said, "So you're an expert in missing data, so how about you try to collect the comments on this concept paper and wrap your head around it?" And well, admittedly, that was the very first time I heard about the word estimate per se. But ever since, I really enjoyed the topic. I think very quickly we figured out that it's much broader than missing data. So it was brought to me as such, but I think we all appreciate by now that it's broader than that. And yeah, I've been working on some aspects around it ever since, currently mostly around recurrent events and time-to-event estimates, so some consideration around that type of endpoint.
Okay.
So maybe I'll stop here.
Okay, very good. So Chrissy, what's your involvement with that?
Hi, so I'm Chrissy Fletcher and I work at Amgen. I'm a TA head in biostatistics for our non-oncology disease areas. I got involved in estimands when we had the draft concept, and a few of us reached out and discussed with Rob Hemmings as the lead for the draft concept what were some of the challenges he was introducing or thinking about before he was submitting it to ICH. So that was through the FSBI and PSI regulatory committee. So we got involved quite early into some of the thinking processes behind the concept paper. And as I'm a member of the FPIA Clinical Development Expert Group, I was able to get involved and become one of the FPIA representatives on the ICH E9 Working Group. It's certainly been a journey that has been very interesting and challenging, and obviously still continues to this day.
Okay, very good. Muna, you mentioned already that, you know, you were put on this problem because of your experience with missing data. But you mentioned that it's much broader than that. So I know that this is the origin, but why has it developed into something that is much broader than handling missing data?
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. So, I think from the background that I've heard from some of our regulatory colleagues, but also internally of people who have been in industry for a bit longer, I think a lot of the challenges that led or that motivated the concept paper really stem from missing data problems. So sometimes you would have, let's say, submissions where we would choose a certain way of handling missing data. And then sometimes the regulatory agencies would maybe disagree on that approach or would prefer an alternative approach. And very often these discussions would happen amongst the decisions, let's say. And in all that discussion, sometimes I believe it was maybe forgotten that we sometimes don't really ask ourselves very carefully why are those data missing? And is the fact that they are missing themselves already telling me something about either efficacy or safety of the drug? So just as an example, so when I joined from a sort of academic head, let's say, when I joined the industry and I consulted on a couple of projects, it wouldn't even cross my mind to ask, are these data really missing or are we just considering them not useful for this analysis? So take a diabetes drug, for example, where patients are sort of observed over several weeks. And some of them then start taking rescue medication when the HbA1c values are not well controlled. And I think the practice in the past was to disregard the data after intake of rescue, although we would sometimes collect that and then do something like last observation carried forward. So I would only get into the problem once people talk about missing data and so on. But I think with this whole estimate discussion, it's becoming more clear that missing data is just one facet of that, but actually all types of data that are, let's say, tainted by either other medications or that where the patients are not fully following the protocol or they are dying, let's say, so the data doesn't exist, it's not missing, it simply doesn't exist. So all these things were sometimes put into one bucket, the missing data bucket, and we statisticians deal with it. And I think this whole estimate discussion has helped us now to take it back out of the bucket, let's say, to talk about it a bit more clearly. And sometimes the mere fact that a patient is not willing to take a drug for 12 weeks or 16 weeks is the key outcome itself. So the information is not missing, although the symptom score itself may be missing. Does that help clarifying?
Yeah. Chrissy, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think... if you think of ICH E9, the key principle in ICH E9 is intention to treat. And those of us who understand E9 will say that intention to treat is all patients randomised and followed through to the outcome. And I think we seem to have maybe lost a little bit of that over many years. And that, again, the missing data report from the NRC back in 2010 really emphasised the need to follow through on patients, whether they were adhering or not to the treatment. And as Muna says, we sort of handled issues with the data as though it was a statistical issue only. So estimands is really taking us all back to square one, is what is it we're trying to estimate? And that's the coin, the estimand. And I think it's making sure that if you do want to take a treatment policy perspective and follow patients after they've been randomised, then we need to make sure we try to minimise truly missing data. But perhaps there are other clinical questions where we do actually want to know what happens to the treatment effect for patients who can tolerate the treatment or do adhere to treatment. But that's a different estimate of our treatment effect. So I think this new framework is giving us more clarity about what it is we're trying to address, what's the key question in a study. And this isn't just a statistical issue, and we do need to think of it as a study objective. What is it we're trying to estimate?
So if I understand it correctly, on the surface, it was some missing data problem, but actually by digging deeper into the actual problem, we identified that we don't have a missing data problem, or we also have a missing data problem, but actually our problem is that we weren't clear on what we actually wanted to measure and which objectives we actually wanted to answer. Because I think commonly we wrote just objectives like, we want to understand the treatment effect of drug A versus drug B in this patient population by that measure or something like this. So we weren't really kind of clear on what treatment effect actually means, yeah?
So if I can start, I think it's even got a bit worse than that. I think we've been calling things intention to treat in the protocol, but we actually are not taking an intention to treat approach. So we have wanted to say we're looking at the effect of a treatment, we're going to be looking at the full analysis set, but in our analysis methods, we actually haven't been applying the intention to treat principle. Okay. So what we have been calling an intention to treat estimate is actually not an intention to treat estimate because of the way we've handled data, not just missing data, but how we've handled patients who, for example, took rescue, or what happens to patients who discontinue. And all these different events matter in terms of what we're estimating.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned already ICH-E9 and that actually currently needs an update, and this update is currently working on and hopefully becoming live next year. There's currently the time where the responses and comments to this draft guideline has closed, and currently people are working on these comments. So Chrissy, can you explain shortly what ICH-E9 is about and why it needs an update?
So ICH-E9 is introducing a new framework for how we design, conduct, and analyze clinical trials. And it's a logical framework that hopes to really bring together the study objectives to define what it is we're estimating, to make sure that the planned analysis methods are aligned to that, what it is we're estimating. And we also have aligned sensitivity analyses. So the E9 addendum, which is an update to E9, it's going to sit as a separate document to E9. Is really trying to realign ourselves to make sure that if we are going to be clear in terms of what we're estimating. But also a big part of the addendum is redefine what we mean by sensitivity analysis. So ICH-E9 currently says that we might use different analysis sets to test the robustness of our trial conclusions. But if we take if we analyze our data and use different patient sets, that in the new framework is going to be a different treatment effect of interest, a different estimand. So we need to make sure that whatever we're doing for sensitivity analyses are now going to be aligned to our estimands of interest.
Yeah, and just for the listeners who are not used to what ICH actually means, that is a regulatory consortium across the world that seeks to harmonize how regulatory submissions are done across the world, so Japan, US, Europe, but also lots of other regulators are involved in that. And E9 specifically speaks about lots of these statistical problems that we have. So we talked already a lot about estimates, and we I think the origin of this, as we talked about, is this missing data, and we already talked about treatment policy and maybe other aspects of that. And if you look into the updates, there's, I think, currently 5 different approaches mentioned to these intercurrent events, which could be dropouts or could be rescue medication or these kind of things. But whenever we talk about statisticians as about estimates, it seems to be very focused on this intercurrent event. But that's not the only key aspect of the estimate, isn't it?
So the intercurrent event is one consideration. And we need to understand what intercurrent events are of interest for our study. But yes, that's one of at least 4 attributes that are going to be really important for an estimand. The other attributes include the population. And the population means the target population that our label is hoping to achieve. We're also interested in the variable or the endpoint of interest. What is it we're going to be basing the treatment effect of interest on? We're also concerned also with the, well, how are we going to summarise the treatment effect? And is that going to be some kind, for example, a difference in means between treatment groups or treatment regimens? So all in all, there's a number of different attributes to an estimand, including the intercurrent events, and together these will make an estimand description. But this estimand description will hopefully enable all stakeholders, including regulators and payers and HTA agencies, to understand what it is we're estimating and how we're handling events that happen in trials in terms of that and how that leads to an estimate of our treatment effect.
So let's go a little bit deeper into that. If we start with population, so you mentioned that the kind of label population, but I guess, you know, within this label population, there could be also different subpopulation for which you would have different estimates. So you could have maybe one where you look for patients with a specific comorbidity or patients with a specific kind of severity of a certain aspect of their disease or things like that. So that is always one of the key elements, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's an important one. Yeah.
Yeah. And if we think about it, this population, is that, I think we often very much think from the exclusion criterion of the study, that is it the study population or are we more talking about the population in which these patients will be prescribed?
It's the latter. We're looking at the target population. What are the patients we hope to treat? And we hope that our study is representative of our target population through the inclusion exclusion criteria. And of course, once we've recruited all our patients, we need to demonstrate that trial population is actually representative of our target population. So if you don't have that, there will be some questions that you'll need to address.
So imagine you have, let's say, a U.S. population. This is maybe one target population, and then the next regulator, it's maybe, let's say, Korea. And in Korea, the patients are, let's say, on average 20 kilos lighter than in the U.S. So, and maybe weight actually plays an important role in your as a treatment effect modifier. So would you need to then kind of have different estimates for these different populations?
I guess you could, right? I mean, if you were looking at a subgroup analysis where you're focusing more on, let's say, Asian patients, then that is certainly still in the remit of what we do. And then actually by defining the population accordingly, which, as you said, may be implemented in terms of the analysis approach and statistics through a model that includes weight or another type of surrogate for that. Mm-hmm. So I personally think that that's still certainly possible. I don't know, Chrissy, would you agree?
Yeah, it comes back to the design. I mean, we also now have ICHE-17, which is a multi-regional clinical trial guideline. So again, if your null hypothesis is that you have a consistent treatment effect across all the regions you're doing the study, then you're assuming a common treatment effect. But if you don't have that and weight is going to be an issue, And if you haven't maybe stratified for weight, then you may have some additional analyses to understand whether you do have a consistent effect between different regions. So it depends on how you design the study, whether that subpopulation is something that you do plan for. You may have a separate estimand specifically to look at Korea, for example, if that was of a question that you wanted your study to address. But the main thing is that you specify that up front and you don't wait for the planned methods of analysis to say that you actually want to look at a subgroup in South Korea or whatever it is. You need to have it up front and aligned to the study objectives.
Okay, very good. Then the second point is we talk about the endpoint. Let's say you have a diabetes study, as you just mentioned, and we are looking into HbA1c. Would then we just say HbA1c is the endpoint, or how would that look like?
So I guess it would depend on your aim, let's say. So let's look at HbA1c as the endpoint, together with the fact that many patients may take rescue medication. So some people may argue the mere fact that you require rescue medication is a sign for lack of efficacy. So it is a failure to the initially randomized treatment, and you could even think about defining the composite endpoint where you require a certain improvement in terms of HbA1c. And in addition, you have to stay on treatment at least for a certain duration. At the end, diabetes is a chronic disease. You want patients to be on treatment for far longer than 12, 24 weeks, right? And I think this whole the whole estimate discussion, at least in my mind, has also helped in phrasing the endpoint in a more clear and transparent way. So sometimes, for example, you would read our endpoint is HbA1c, and then in the missing data handling section, you read we do non-responder imputation for patients that take rescue. So really, the endpoint is a composite endpoint where you require a certain improvement on HbA1c and you have to stay on treatment. But in the past, sometimes by saying these are in separate sections of the protocol, you actually have to look at different places to really know how to interpret the treatment effect estimate that you get at the end. So the endpoint also is affected by intercurrent events in certain settings.
Okay, so these four different aspects that we are currently talking about, they are somehow related to each other. They can't kind of, you can very often if you change one, you also change something else.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So coming back maybe briefly to a point that you said earlier, that a lot of statisticians, when they talk about estimates, mostly focus on intercurrent events. So I think in a way that's almost a good thing, because really that I think a lot of the discussions around estimand boil down to how do we account or how do we capture these intercurrent events, which themselves show us a different perspective on the treatment effect. And they can impact the population, they can impact the endpoint, they can impact the summary measure or how to account for intercurrent events themselves. So given that in the past we have already focused quite a bit, or that's normal, or it comes normal to us to focus on population, endpoint, and summary measure, the focus on intercurrent events is actually, I guess, the good new thing with this estimate framework.
Chrissy, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, and I think that the other thing that the estimate discussion is now bringing out is, are we being clear on what are the treatments that we're comparing? Some trials, all patients are on a background therapy. It may be truly placebo-controlled in naive patients. You may have a more complex study where patients are randomised in oncology. They have some kind of induction therapy and move on to consolidation therapy. Well, in all these different scenarios, I think another sort of highlight to me is making sure that we're being clear on what it is we're comparing between. So is it just a placebo versus a new active? Or is it standard of care plus new versus standard of care plus placebo? And I think over time we've lost in some way, what is it, how we label some of our treatment regimens in our studies. So the estimands will also now make it clearer in terms of what is it we're comparing against and at what point we're comparing those treatments. the different strategies to handling intercurrent events are also enabling us to take different approaches. So you're not just taking the same approach for all intercurrent events. There's lots more flexibility allowed in terms of how you want to handle each intercurrent event. But again, the challenge will be is coming up with a very nice estimand description, but also being able to then use appropriate methods to estimate that estimand. And as anything we know, statisticians, there's a number of methods we can use, but what's the most unbiased method? So what's going to be the most appropriate method? And what assumptions are being made? And actually, how can I then verify those assumptions by doing different analyses as part of my sensitivity analyses to check that I'm still aligned and I actually do generate a robust estimate at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think this term bias, I think, is a really important one because it also helps us to think about bias means we are systematically estimating something that we actually don't want to estimate. And there's a difference between our what we want to estimate and the estimator and the expected estimator. And but for that, first we need to be clear on what we want to estimate. And I think that was one of the big problems in the past that we weren't really clear about that. And I think my perception is all this framework helps really with vocabulary to explain what we are really doing. And what I got from your comments, Chrissy, is that maybe another kind of dimension to the estimate framework is actually treatment or what we are actually comparing, which could be kind of treatment, but it could also be kind of treatment, a treatment policy or, you know, or something like that. And that kind of also is associated with population, isn't it? Because maybe you're studying in a specific population that has a specific kind of pre-treatment or concomitant therapy. So that feeds into this treatment as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's exactly a good example where, and as Muna says, all these things are interrelated. So patients coming into a trial may have had to fail some prior therapy. They may have had specific previous lines of therapy. And you may or may not need to be very specific in your population, but that is what you're studying in your trial. So sometimes the prior medications is really important to highlight as part of that population statement. Or you may be clarifying that it is patients who have had certain therapies that you want to be in your population, your target population. And of course, and sometimes in our clinical trials, we have patients who come into the trials that actually failed an inclusion-exclusion criteria. Well, what are we going to do with those patients? How does that impact what we're trying to estimate? And so the population is really trying to make us clear what patients are we treating in our trial and how does that relate to our target population?
Okay. The third aspect in the this estimate framework is about the how we actually then measure, what kind of statistics do we use. So there we need to be very specific in terms of whether we look into response differences or odds ratios or relative risks or these kind of things, isn't it?
That's correct. So we call it the summary measure, and it is what it is we're going to be using to differentiate the treatment effects. And there's been a lot of discussion, particularly in time to event analyses, where, for example, if we're looking at a survival endpoint, we often will use the hazard ratio as the summary measure. But of course, we all know that in order to use the hazard ratio, we're assuming proportional hazards. And we don't often have that in our clinical trial. So there's lots of discussions around what would be an appropriate summary measure in time to event or time kind of analyses. I think in other analyses, it's quite straightforward. But we would, if we're looking at change from baseline, we would look at the difference in means. Again, assuming normality, and we would like to test that. And if we need to transform the data, we would obviously do so. But Mina, would you have any thoughts?
No, I think that was nicely summarized. I guess, I mean, the summary measure is essentially asking us to specify what is the particular aspect of these curves, let's say, that we want to focus on. In survival, that could be like the survival difference at a certain time point. It could be the hazard ratio. But as Christy has said, this comes with some interpretational challenges unless you really have the proportional hazard assumption holding, which, of course, at the design stage and so on, you won't, I mean, you don't know in general. So it's sort of appreciating that at the end of the day, while we have all the data and the totality of that information, we want to combine it somehow and condense it. And the question is, on which aspect is it relevant and appropriate to condense it so that we have something that's interpretable, not only to us, the decisions, but also to the clinicians. At the end, it will be in the label, so to treating physicians and patients. And while it seems almost trivial, so we have to state the summary measure, I think through the discussions around the estimate framework, I think some of these things that we have taken for granted throughout the last decades, let's say, so some established practices are in fact being sort of revisited and sometimes even questioned, whether sometimes maybe we have to rethink how we can summarize these curves or the totality of the data in an appropriate way. So that's another plus I see, although it seems very simple to start with. Yeah,
it seems really simple, but I think it's in the simplicity, it helps us to be also more transparent and more also that it's very clear in what we are want to do. So, for example, if we want to analyze a binary endpoint, we are upfront saying how actually we want to measure it, whether we, you know, look into odds ratios or risk differences or whatsoever, because I think very often that would only appear then maybe in the specifications of the table, what you actually present, rather than somewhere in the protocol or the SAP. You may just say, oh, we'll do a logistic regression. But what do you present then from the logistic regression?
And to me, in fact, I think it would be pretty important, for example, the odds ratio, right? I mean, that's a term we use, and many clinicians will probably also know what it means. But it would almost be nicer if we could sort of put it in layman's words. What does it mean? Mm-hmm. So that the estimate, ideally, at least in my mind, should be something that we write together with the whole clinical team. And if we then give it to a treating physician or even a patient, ideally they should be able to understand what it means. And odds ratio, to be honest, is not something that my mom, I guess, would pick up and think, yeah, of course, I understand that. So it also gives us this opportunity to sort of try and phrase things in a way that we can communicate it in a transparent and clear way with patients and so on.
And I think that's going to be a key focus going forward, is that we'll have a number of different estimands that we will want to get out of our trials, and that's perfectly fine. There are different stakeholders who are interested in different treatment effects. Me as a patient, I could be interested in one estimate of treatment effect, which is different to a clinician who's treating a whole group of patients. And that's different to a healthcare system. Well, what is the population going to be able to achieve if I prescribe this treatment? But we do need to specify these all up front and be clear why are they different. And by that description, we'll understand why they're different. But as Mina says, they need to be understood by a layman, and we can't make it technical. Like, there could be a technical version of an estimand, but we do need to be able to describe estimands very clearly so that all our stakeholders, including patients, can understand what it is we're estimating.
That's actually a very, very good topic. So it's not only something for regulatory interactions. It's much broader than that. So it basically forms the basis that we can communicate with many, many stakeholders. You mentioned prescribing physicians, patients, payers, you know, insurance companies or government agencies that inform payers on a national level. So it really affects everything in our industry. And I think this is so fundamental to what we are doing, that every statistician really needs to be well trained on these kind of things, because it affects setting up studies, it affects reading studies, it affects analyzing studies, it affects communicating about study, publishing about study, interpretation, critiquing other studies, all these kind of different things it has an impact on. And even if you work only, let's say, if you work on integrating studies from different sources into something, you need to be very, very clear on what you're trying to estimate. And I think there, in these, even in these network meta-analysis kind of areas, something that more works along these lines would help a lot. Although they actually have the PICO statement, which more or less goes into the same direction, where they say, okay, which studies they want to look into, which interventions they want to look into, and so on. It goes a little bit into this direction, but I think it's not as elaborate as the estimate framework. And the estimate framework is much more detailed and clear in terms of what's being done there.
So there is, I think there are links between PCOS and the Estimands framework. There's not exactly a match per se, but there's a lot of synergy. I think people should realise now, though, that the Estimands will impact design of future studies, but also how we do synthesise evidence. But we've had that problem now, that where people are calling an intention to treat estimate and merging it with other intention to treat estimates across studies, when actually we don't really know, and unless you go deep into the methods, how was the estimate of treatment effect actually derived? So I think we've been using labels a lot, but now we're going to we need the statistical community to actually look into the details. What is it that for that particular trial is published? How was the treatment effect derived? Especially if we're going to be doing meta-analyses or network meta-analyses, making sure that we are comparing apples and apples. Unfortunately, though, we may only have the published information, so we may need to understand what has been estimated and appropriately use that in our subsequent meta-analysis. But even in designing new studies going forward, think about non-inferiority trials. We have to look at our non-inferiority margins. Well, often we'll go back to previous studies and look at the placebo-controlled trial for the comparator that we're using. Well, how was that estimand defined? And how does that compare to the estimand we're going to be defining in our new non-inferiority study? So I think, again, going forward, we're going to have better clarity at what we're doing and how we're doing it, and understanding maybe some of the nuances that do exist now, but we'll be more transparent about them.
Yeah, and I think it gives us the opportunity to interact much more meaningful with our non-statistical colleagues, be it on the regulatory side or on the medical side or the medical writing side or whatsoever, because now we can pull it out of the stats own section and really put it where it belongs, into the objectives, into the discussion part of papers, and speak there about it, and not just have it labeled as that's the stats part and the statisticians talk to the other statisticians about it. It's something where all the different stakeholders need to be involved.
Yeah, and if there's one take-home message today from this podcast, is please do not think of estimands as a statistical issue only. It is a cross-functional effort that we need to make sure that the estimand is aligned to our study objectives. The estimand does not belong in the statistical analysis plan only. We need it specified in the protocol, aligned to our study objectives. Of course, we'll have much more details about it in the statistical analysis plan, but do not let your colleagues say, oh, this only just sits in the statistical analysis plan. We will be providing some further guidance through Transcelerate. So Transcelerate is a consortium of industry partners who have developed a common protocol template. That has been updated recently, and a new version is coming out. which has actually incorporated Estermans into its template. So I'm hoping that will also give more credence to making sure that the Estermand is described alongside the objective and it does not just reside in the statistical analysis plan.
Yeah, and that's actually a very, very nice point. I'm planning to record another episode about Transcelerate with one of my colleagues here at Lilly that is working on exactly that point. And so stay tuned to this episode in the future. Speaking about events in the future, we talked that there's a huge need for all statisticians to be trained on these kind of different topics. What's going on there? Can you speak a little bit to what PSI is doing in terms of that to help training people and get everybody up to speed regarding this? The estimate topic?
So as part of the scientific committee, I can share what the scientific committee is planning for 2019. So following up from 2018, where we had a couple of sessions around estimates at the conference, which I think were very well attended, but also we received good feedback for those. And usually at the end of the conference, we then ask for interest in additional topics for next year's conference and next year one day meeting. And not surprisingly, estimand was yet again one of the hot topics that people were requesting and interested in. So we therefore decided to run an additional PSI one-day meeting early next year. So the date is fixed for the 29th of January, where we will be focusing on new emerging topics around estimand and the ICH E9 addendum. So as you have, Alexander, you and Chrissy have briefly mentioned before, so the draft addendum is currently being revised. The 1,000 plus comments are being read, and I'm sure the working group is having a busy time trying to incorporate these into an updated draft. So one of the aims of the meeting in the beginning of next year is really to share the feedback from the public consultations and maybe to discuss some future steps. So what are maybe some of the changes that are to be anticipated? Then also related to something we discussed before, so while I believe the ICH-9 addendum focuses on confirmatory clinical trials, the topic itself affects a much broader set of studies, but also different stakeholders. And we briefly touched upon HTA. So HTA considerations will also be covered at this one-day meeting. So we will have Anja Schiel from the Norwegian Medicines Agency, who will talk about the link between estimand and HTA considerations. And then I think something that many of us have realized in the past, and to be honest, I have only, after being into the estimand topic for around a year, where I thought this is somewhat new, I sort of realized that in the causal inference community, this has been there a long time. So the estimands, like defining estimands as well as being clear around when can you even estimate certain estimands, what are the assumptions that are needed, what are appropriate sensitivity analysis. So a lot of these considerations have already been taken place in the causal inference community. So not surprisingly, there's a lot to be learned from that community as well. And therefore, an additional aspect of this one-day meeting will be around causal inference and how that fits with estimates and clinical trials. We will, of course, have some case studies being presented that are at that interface. And yeah, I think it promises to be a very interesting day. So that is certainly one activity of the PSI. And then there will be sessions at the PSI conference. So the next year's conference, as you all know, is the beginning of June, I believe, in London. So there will also be case studies hopefully being presented. And also a more dedicated session where the PSI RSS winner on estimand, on that award that was given for work on estimands will be presenting some of the work as well. So I would just say, stay tuned. I'm sure there will be even some additional things coming up. And I'm also sure that some other associations in Europe and US and beyond are actually thinking about some conference sessions and so on the topic.
Within FPIA, we also have a working group of about 70 people now, both combined with FPIA and FSPI. So that's enabling us to work directly with clinicians. And the ICH have also released 200 slides of training materials on the addendum, on the draft addendum. So the link went around in the SBI newsletter. So look at the ICH website under E9, and there's a series of training slides that are accessible to everybody. And I would encourage everyone to use those within your companies to train cross-functionally on the topic of estimands.
Very good. And the links to these kind of different things will also be in the show notes. So just go to theeffectivestatistician.com, check out this episode, which will be called The Past, Present and Future of Estimates. And there you will find the link to the PSI one-day event at IQVIA in the UK end of January. As well as other documents that we mentioned today. So thanks so much, Chrissy and Muna, for this very, very nice interview on this super relevant and hot topic at the moment. And hope you enjoyed this show. If you have any kind of suggestions for future topics you would like to learn about, if you have suggestions on how to improve this overall podcast, please let me know. Just go to theeffectivestatistician.com and leave a comment there. So with that, thanks so much to Muna and Chrissy.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks for listening. Please visit theeffectivestatistician.com to find the show notes and learn more about our podcast to boost your career as a statisticians in the health sector. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your colleagues about it.